Psalm 65. I don't know if you have a title on that psalm. In my Bible, it says God's Care for the Earth. I don't know what comes to mind when you see a psalm with a title like that in our modern age. If you're thinking the Bible is just suddenly turned kind of liberal-minded, or it's kind of like, you know, tree huggers or save the earth, but and you wonder how does this connect with us as a modern day American audience. I mean, some of you might enjoy gardening. I doubt any of you have a farm in your backyard, especially if you live in Highlands Ranch. So sometimes a psalm like this that's full of these kind of language of like agriculture and land and flocks and so forth, sometimes can kind of pass us by and we miss some of the depth that God offers us in a psalm like this. So a key interpretive principle that we need to keep in mind is that this is a harvest psalm. It does have this agrarian kind of agricultural tone to it. So just be aware of that and lean into that kind of language. Don't be like, well, I don't know what that means. Understand that there's going to be language in here that's celebrating in a way that would speak deeply to a farming or agrarian agriculture kind of setting. And another interpretive key to keep in mind is we can't miss the order that we see in this psalm. And this psalm is organized into three stanzas. So we're going to have just kind of three main ideas that we're going to reflect on this morning from the psalm. The first one is God's grace brings sinners near. That's where the psalm starts. It celebrates this reality, this fact. The second stanza, or the second main idea that this psalm is going to help us reflect on, is God's presence brings stability. And then the final stanza, or main idea that we'll see in this psalm, is how God blesses with overflowing generosity. But notice the order here, that forgiveness comes before fruitfulness. We often like to jump right into the fruitful language, the celebration language of the fruitfulness. That's what we want God to give to us and help us experience. We need to understand that there's an order here that God has given us in His Word. It's a good order. It's an order we can celebrate. Forgiveness comes before fruitfulness. And that really is the heartbeat of the Christian gospel, by the way. So why is praise rightfully due to God? Or why should we praise God? You see verse 1, why is it that we should praise God? Why is He bursting at the seams with praise here, David is? Well, we understand that because God's grace brings sinners near. Sometimes psalms start in the pit. As we've been through some of those, this yearning, God, where are you? I thirst for you. Seem like you're anywhere around. Sometimes psalms start in the pit and then rise to this place of praise, but this psalm starts right out at praise. It's almost like you're walking up the stairs here to gather with your church family, and you're already humming a tune. And then you join in, and we start singing together. That's kind of what this psalm is like. God is not distant. He is the God who answers. You see that verse 2? Oh, you who hear prayer, to you all flesh come. He's the God who welcomes all people. All people. In verse 3, he's talking about how when iniquities prevail, I love how this celebration of God is so, it's not naive. It's real. Because sin is an overwhelming problem. In fact, it is your greatest problem. And so this psalm celebrates the forgiveness that is experienced from God, and that forgiveness is a gift. It's not earned, it's granted. In verse 3, that's debt and condemnation that we owe for our transgression or our sin, this rebellion against God's rightful rule in our life. That is something that God has paid for us. He's atoned for that, is the word that's used there in verse 3. And he moves right into then verse 4. It's almost like, I don't know if this makes any sense, but if you're familiar at all with jazz, you can understand how like jazz riffs kind of play off of one another. It's almost like he's doing that with his words here in a poem. As he continues in verse 4, blessed is the one you choose and bring near. And he summarizes that. What does it mean to be brought near to God? What's the experience of that? We shall be satisfied with the goodness of your house. So this opening stanza is meant to stir us to praise God by shocking us with the extravagance of God's sheer grace. These verses are a clear expression of who God is, of what the gospel of Jesus Christ is. How God is the one who proactively solves our issue of sin so that he can bring sinners near to himself and into his presence. David understands that it's God who takes the action. God is the one who hears our prayer. He's the one that atones for our rebellions. He's the one that brings us near into his courts. And this is, by the way, the same sentiment that Jesus talked about when he was on earth teaching in John chapter 6. And Jesus says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him." Or again later in John chapter 15, Jesus says, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." Now sometimes that kind of language in the New Testament or even in the Old Testament, like we have here in Psalm 65, sometimes that can offend our modern sensibilities because we'd like to think that, you know, that I am experiencing something great with God because I chose God. We kind of feel a little bit diminished or threatened as if we didn't have free agency in our experience or relationship with God. Friends, God has something so much deeper for us. You see, there isn't a safer or more secure reality that your nearness to someone isn't something you've achieved or earned or accomplished, but it's something that has been given. That's true for any relationship. And that's certainly true for our relationship with God. There is no safer or more secure reality that your nearness to God is not something you've achieved or earned or initiated of your own doing, but it's something that God has accomplished. He sought you out. I mean, we've heard of stories, right? Love stories where somebody says, "Well, you know, I asked her numerous times. She said no, she said no, she said no. And I finally just kind of convinced her to kind of relent and you know, give in." And we kind of laugh about that. And then there's other love stories that are this kind of sense of being kind of swooned, being pursued and being, you see what I mean? And there's this sense of God has seeking sinners. He seeks you. There's no safer experience. Because if you've achieved God's attention, if you've somehow merited it, if you somehow figured out life so that you knew to choose God of your own doing, then really, then it's all up to you to maintain it and to keep it. But that's not how we relate to God. And Psalm 65 is bursting with praise at the sheer extravagance of God's grace. He delights to choose sinners. Paul said, "While we were in our sin, Christ died." So David delights in being brought near to God into his courts. And David is using this idea of like a throne room. He's a king, right? He understands a court and kind of those that would be near him and with him to help him rule and do well. And you think, "Well, cool, David, that's kind of neat for you, but what about us?" And you know what? I wonder if David could even imagine what we know about a relationship with God through Christ now. Because we're not just brought into the court of God, kind of this ruling chamber of God, this professional environment of God. No, through Christ, we don't just visit God's courts. Through Christ, God makes us his children. You see, David is bursting with praise at the sheer extravagance of God's grace, and yet he doesn't quite know all of it yet. I mean, because we now, looking back at what Christ has done, and we're going to celebrate and remember that through the Lord's Supper this morning, we've not just been brought into his courtroom, so to speak, we have been brought into his family. We're not just members of his royal court, we're members of his family. So John chapter 1 says it this way, "But to all who did receive Christ, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." Isn't that astonishing? Or Romans 8 says, if we're children of God, right? Well, here's the reality then you're an heir. You're heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. I mean, this status that we have with God through Christ is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. The sheer extravagance of God's grace. This is the kind of relationship that God offers to us by his grace. That's why David is so full of praise. He's like bursting at the seams with praise. God, praise is rightfully due you. Verse 4 then describes what the Christian life really is or should be when you experience God's grace like that. You see, it's meant to be a life that's satisfied in God. The goodness of God's house which is a reference to his hospitality to sinners who he's chosen to bring near. That's meant to fill you. And here's the challenge, though. In our modern minds, our kind of modern age Western American minds, we often like to think and analyze. But David isn't writing here just for you to think about it and analyze it. He's not writing to inform you. He's writing so that God can fill you. That who he is and who he seeks you as a God to relate with is a God that he intends to be the one who satisfies you with the goodness of his house. It's like he says, come on in, open the fridge, take whatever you want. That's the hospitality that you have in God. In other words, satisfaction in God is the goal. That's the goal. Satisfaction in God is not an option. It's not like, well, be a Christian and kind of get your life figured out and maybe solve some problems in your life and make life a little more survivable and you'll figure this thing out with God later. No. No, no. God is the gospel. Knowing and relating God with God, that is the whole point of the gospel of Jesus dying. It's not just to give you kind of health and wealth. It's to give you him. He is the goal. So what does all this mean then? How does or how can this make a difference in your daily life here in modern Western America? Well, if you've been brought near to God through the forgiveness of sin that he offers you, which is what David has been writing about here, then that means, in verse 2, it means you can pray with confidence because God hears you. Not because of your actions or your accomplishments, but he hears you because he is the one, in see verse 3, your iniquities overwhelm you. It's like David is overwhelmed with this problem. He doesn't even know how to start solving that problem of sin. It's just overwhelming. And he's comforted to know that he can pray because God hears him. How is it that God would ever hear a sinner pray? Because you've been forgiven. That's why. So you can confess anything to God. Anything. You can draw near to God then with hopefulness as well. And maybe that's what you need this morning, hope. Maybe hope is dying in your heart. You need hope, and the hope you can find here is offered to us in Psalm 65 because God doesn't want for you just to kind of have bare survival. What he wants is he wants to satisfy you in his presence. That's what God offers you, satisfaction in his presence. Where do you look for satisfaction? What do you look to for satisfaction? We'll talk about that more as he gets into this language about the land and harvests and fields and hills, but stanza 1 of this psalm is teaching us that grace is what gathers us to God. That's God's grace. But then he moves on into the second stanza, and in that stanza, we see that God's presence brings stability. Verses 5 through 8. This language here is just beautiful. The poetry of it. He talks about, in verse 5, God's awesome deeds is how he answers us. He's the hope of all the ends of the earth. There's some prophetic language there. Or verse 6, he talks about forming the mountains. He talks about this stilling the roaring of the seas and calming the tumult of the peoples. Verse 7. And then in verse 8, there's this language, again, he's like painting a word picture about the ends of the earth. People are in awe, and with the ends of the earth in mind, he then talks about those both ends, east and west, right? Sunrise and sunset. It's like creation is bursting with praise to God, just like David is. So what's happening in this stanza? Well, verse 2, David spoke about God hearing prayer. And that's a comfort. Some of you have had that experience where somebody says, what can I do? And you've said, you've done enough. You've just heard me. You've just listened. Thanks for listening. Right? There's like psychological error about being heard. God hears. But how does God answer? What kind of answer can we expect from a God who is delighted to gather sinners to himself through sheer grace? Well, God answers in ways that are awe-inspiring, right? You see verse 5? He answers in righteousness with awe-inspiring works. And there's this, we can't really unpack this, but there's this, in verse 1, this vows to you will be fulfilled. There is actually a word in there that talks about silence. And it's almost like the Hebrew language is saying that this response to God with his bursting with praise is so full of praise, it's like words escape him. He just stands in silent awe And he's kind of picking up that theme here when he talks about how God's answer, it's awe-inspiring deeds. And awe is what? It silences you, right? You're just kind of processing this. It's awesome. David celebrates God's awe-inspiring deeds of justice and mercy because they're done on behalf of his people. And what's so great about what God does, what's so awesome about it, is God does it flawlessly. He's not like somebody who really wishes that he could do something, and he tries his best, and he kind of fumbles it, and you know, only like 50% of what God does, it really works, and the rest is kind of like, well, you tried, thanks. That's not God at all. Everything he sets out to do, all of his answers are perfectly fitted, perfectly suited. Words perfectly spoken. Truth perfectly applied. He never gets it wrong. There's no misguided or well-intended effort, but wrongly applied. God is never a Job's friend. In verses 6 through 8, then, David continues describing the Lord and uses this language about mountains being established and how God silences the roaring of the seas and the waves. And I mean, we have the advantage, right, in Colorado. We look at these mountains, these rocky mountains. What if you were, how would you dig out a mountain? Right? I mean, it's like we can't hardly dig out a tree stump, let alone dig out a mountain. Like, how deep do the roots of a mountain go? How long would it take for us, all of humanity working together, to try to dig out a mountain? It's like, do we have to even try? That's the word picture. He's overwhelming us with this sense of awesomeness, of stability, is what I think is what he's going after here. He's going after stability because the next word picture that he uses is a word picture about how it's not just this the rockiness of the massive presence of a mountain that is so stable, but then he goes on and he talks about the roaring of the waves of a sea. And I mean, if you have ever been on rough waters, it can be a terrifying experience, right? I mean, the bigger the ship you're in, the better in rough water. But I remember as a kid growing up on Lake Winnebago and in my dad's little 16-foot aluminum Lund fishing boat, and there would be times where we'd be fishing with some friends, and on the crest of the wave, we could see our friend's boat, and in the trough, we couldn't see their boat. And then we would just swap places. It'd be like, hey, over there, and then the waves. And there's times where it can be scary. How would you go about stopping the waves of the ocean? Again, there's this impossibility of it. Yet, David is calling out that God's power is so great and mighty, it can calm something that we think is impossible to calm. Like maybe the turmoil in your own heart. How about that ocean and all those waves? And then he goes on and talks about how God doesn't just bring calmness into places of chaos, but there's like, okay, you get it with nature, fine, but then you start thinking about, well, but people often cause the greatest turmoil in our life, don't they? Can't they? What about that? And he talks directly into that. God's power is present over people too. He talks about how God calms, he stills, in verse 7, he stills the tumult of peoples. And it's, he doesn't have just in mind the people in his own life, yes, but you think about just national events that happen, countrywide, geographic kind of things that like make it onto the world news tonight kind of things. Like, how do you start going about calming those things? How are you going to start settling that down? And God says, I got that. I can do that. I can bring peace there. So all of this reaches a crescendo then in verse 8. All of this is for this purpose, you see, so that those who dwell at the ends of the earth are in awe at your signs. Now, this language about all of those that are the ends of the earth is specifically used here by David to make a point. And the emphasis is on the allness. This isn't just something that is meant for Israel, but it's meant for the world, all nations. And David is wanting us, he's celebrating God's grace. His grace is what gathers us. His grace is what stabilizes us. It calms the turmoil of sin, but also God's grace breaks all boundaries of nation and race and class. Every boundary to every nation and race and class, God's grace is offered and calms. At the end of verse 8, David beautifully ties nature's praise to God's reign. He talks about sunrises and sunsets. Those who live far away are awed by your signs. You make east and west shout for joy. That's a reference to all people, again, but on the idea of that, kind of the sunrise and the sunset are getting involved in this chorus of praise as well. So what's happening here is, like, how many sunrises and sunsets have happened in your life that you didn't even think about? They just happened. They're just there. Now, certainly, there's times that we go out and look at the sunrise, look at the sunset, we enjoy it, it's momentous, we take note of it, but it just happens every day, right? Every day. And we kind of just take it for granted. And what I think David is doing here is he's pointing out how even these seemingly in the background type of events, they're all part of God's story. They're all an active part of what God is doing. They're not insignificant. And there's a chorus of praise happening all the time. Even when your heart doesn't seem to find a reason to praise, creation, the world, keeps shouting praise. It's never silenced. It's there every morning. It's there every night. And there's an invitation here then in this psalm for us to join in creation's choir of praise to God. His grace gathers us. He brings us near. He makes us his family. What does he do? His power is real and it calms. It brings stability into our lives. This second stanza of the psalm teaches us that the one who formed the mountains and the one who stills the seas is sovereign Lord over every chaos, personal, political, you name it. So this psalm then invites us to trust God's sovereignty in our turmoil, to be stabilized by who he is, a God who gathers sinners. Of course, this psalm doesn't offer a quick fix. That's what we want, right, in our modern age. We want an app, right? We want some sort of, you know, quick fix, some sort of thing we can do to make things better. But what it does is it invites us to lift our eyes beyond our own troubles to see a God who is involved in a global work. His glory is global. And we get so focused on trying to see his glory in our little world, and we can't find it. We can't see it. And what Psalm 65 is doing is David is so full of bursting with praise. He's saying, lift your eyes and take a glance at what God's doing. It's a global God, a global saving work. He stabilizes not just your little world, but the whole world. So let that vision fill you. Psalm 65 invites us to let the ordinary and often overlooked realities of life, like a sunrise and a sunset, become bells of celebration, like a church tower with bells ringing, to break through into our hard hearts to invite us into that same praise. So Psalm 65, so far we've seen that it's grace that gathers us. We see that it's his presence that stabilizes us. And third, in this final stanza, we see it's God's generosity. He blesses with overflowing generosity. Verses 9 through 13 are one of the most beautiful portraits of God's blessing on land, really in all the Bible. I mean, you can go to some prophetic passages that talk about this at length, but Psalm 65 is just full of this rich language of celebration. God is celebrated and praised as the source of all life and blessing. I mean, you see in verse 9, you visit the earth. And by the way, look at in verses 9, verse 10, verse 11, how often the word you is repeated in those verses. I mean, there it again, David is just kind of bell-toning his praise to God and giving God the credit and recognizing God's activeness in the blessing. So where God is present, everything thrives. That's what he's telling us here. You see verses 9 through 13, God visits the earth. He waters it. I mean, right in Colorado, that's one big difference. I was born and raised in Wisconsin. Grass just grows all the time there. We didn't have sprinkler systems. I realized when I moved to Colorado that if you don't have a sprinkler system on your yard, you won't have grass. In fact, the first home we moved into, it had been vacant for a year, and the front yard looked like the surface of the moon. And I had to be scraped and started entirely over. And so this reference to water, especially in an arid climate like the Jews of this would have been reading, that idea of this water, God's stream is filled with water, right? It's not a stream that is only there seasonally, but it's that stream is there and you can count on it. It brings life to everything around it. That's the word picture that David is using. He talks about how the ground, it's crowned. There's this year that crowns the year with bounty. Like there's a bumper crop year is kind of this idea. And then he talks about the wilderness grasslands and hillsides and meadows and the valleys are getting involved in this chorus of praise. Again, our modern kind of technology, you know, age kind of loses some of the significance of this. But the imagery here is really, it should remind us of Eden. That's what this imagery should bring to mind. It's Edenic. It calls to mind this scene of Genesis where there's this river and this bountiful, growing, flourishing wholeness there, right? A land undefiled and uncursed. The pastures of the wilderness in verses 11 to 12, it talks about how they are like literally dripping. Your carts overflow with plenty in verse 11. And you've done this with like a wheelbarrow full of dirt and you're trying, remember, you know, trying to carry a wheelbarrow full of dirt and dirt as you're walking along, it's bouncing and dirt's spilling out. Well, now imagine that picture with you've gotten so much out of your garden that the wheelbarrow that you're rolling out of the garden is there's so much in that wheelbarrow that there's produce just falling out. That's the idea here. There's too much to gather. This sense of overflowing generosity. And then David personifies creation in verses 12 and following, and it's as if the hills are a person. It's like they're gathering up their robes, so to speak, and they're encircled with joy. It's like the hills have this garment of joy, like wildflowers are growing, and the belt that's holding it all together is this belt of joy. So the point here is what? God's generosity, but notice how the psalm started. It started with emphasizing God's presence. He gathers us to his presence. He atones for our sin. He takes care of this overwhelming problem. And now we get into this area of blessing. So the point here is that all creation is happy because God is there. That's how the psalm is ending. It's emphasizing the presence of God as the source of blessing. Does God's presence bring your soul gladness? David celebrates, right? He's envisioning the blessing of God. It's creating this reality where everything is working as it should. That's how he perceives it. And it's important to realize that it's God's presence that creates that beauty, that fullness, that generosity. And what makes it so that your life is kind of like that wheelbarrow where good things are just falling out? It's the presence of God. That's what's envisioned there. It's not a political outcome. It's not a non-profit strategy. It's not a clever application of wealth or technology that brings fullness to us as human beings. Now, there's a place for some of those things. Yes, they're good gifts, but what the language here, though, the language that's being used is ultimately that knowing God himself, he is the one, he is the source of all blessing. So what do we do with this language then of abundance and prosperity? Maybe we're like, well, do we dare say that? Because maybe there's areas of your life that don't feel like it's abundant. Your wheelbarrow feels empty, not full. And we have examples in the scriptures. In fact, turn back a page and it's full of it, right? David, the same guy who writes 65 is the one who wrote, God, where are you? I'm thirsty. Right? Now he's talking about my wheelbarrow is so full, I can't keep it all in. What are we going to do with this language? Well, I believe a proper understanding of the psalm emphasizes it's God's active care and knowledge of creation is what gives us stability and comfort and hope. And you say, well, so what? Well, it changes our perspective then of created joys. I mean, David is celebrating a stream. He's celebrating crops. So what this can do then is it means that these created joys like grain and rivers and crops grown in fertile soil using Psalm 65 language. You can kind of modernize it for our experience. But these are not rivals to God. They're road signs to Him. They're invitations to join in this chorus of praise. They're good things. They're meant to kindle in your heart an enjoyment of God. They're not meant to compete with God. And that's where we get things wrong. And that's often where we drain out the fullness that God offers us in created things. We try to make them all satisfying in our hearts, and God says, no, that's what I'm supposed to do for you. But here are good created gifts that are road signs to point you to me. They're meant to kindle in your heart a hunger for me. That's what God is saying. I wonder if there's things that we should all struggle with this, right? That we might have elevated in our lives to a place that supersedes God as our all-satisfying one. Has God given you abundance? Do you feel like your heart and life is full? Well then, how can you share that with others for their joy in God? Because when we do that, you see in verse 13, it's like he's driving all of this into, they shout in triumph, indeed they sing, is how this psalm is ending. It's talking about this chorus of creation, and the emphasis is, this assumption is, that you are going to join in that chorus too. Because you've received the greatest gift of all, forgiveness of sin and being brought near to God. So since it's God who brings the blessing, our work then also has a sense of dignity. This Psalm 65 teaches us that. Whether you are working on Wall Street or whether you are cleaning the street, God is the one that brings the blessing. I mean, David is pointing that out here. I mean, sure, you can apply your hard work and your clever thinking and your creative strategies and your resourcefulness. Yes, but even all of that is a gift from God. God is the one who brings blessing wherever it shows up, not you. And so that gives us a sense of dignity in all the work that we do. And it brings stabilizing. It calms the anxiety in our hearts. And Psalm 65 also, because God is the one who brings the blessing, He is the one of abundance. It means we don't have to lose heart. The bountiful and abundant harvest envisioned in the psalm whispers to us of a greater harvest that we will all experience if we know Christ. It makes us think of Revelation 21, and you'll have to read that on your own time. Revelation 21, where it reminds us that Eden was lost, yes, but God isn't done. He's going to make all things new. He's not going to make all new things. He's going to make all things new. It's even better. And so this gospel, this psalm really, we'll finish up here by understanding how it teaches us about the gospel. At the cross of Christ, judgment fell so mercy could flow. What is the stream that brings joy into our hearts? What is the crop that's produced in our lives that brings us joy? It would be the crop of the fruit of God's Spirit made possible through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Of God's justice falling on the cross of Christ so God's mercy could flow to us. This is why Jesus came into the world. He says it in John 10. He says, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Maybe that's how you have felt life is. But Jesus says, He has come that they might have life and have it abundantly. Psalm 65 starts with praise. It's not naive praise, though. It's real. It stares at guilt. It stares at turmoil. It looks at need, and then it lifts its head, and he sees God as the one who solves that problem and invites us to join in this chorus of praise. Psalm 65 is an invitation for us all to come near to God and find satisfaction in Him.